Mr. Hudson is going to be giving his lecture on Kundalini, which is a subtitle, Its Value in Physical and Superphysical Research, and it is fully illustrated. Now, I would just like to enlarge upon that a little bit and say that contrary to his normal procedure, Mr. Hodgson has agreed to the projection of slides illustrating himself whilst attempting research concerning fossils beneath the veldt in South Africa, under the direction of the paleontologist, Dr. John Robertson. And Mr. Hodgson has also agreed to the production of the sound of his voice as he attempted this research. So now I think it is only my pleasure to introduce Mr. Hodgson. Probably now doesn't need much introducing to a great number of you, but I will, just the same, introduce Mr. Hodgson to you and ask him to give his lecture on Kundalini. Mr. Hodgson.
Madam Chairman and fellow students, I feel deeply moved, especially on this occasion, my last public lecture in this life, if I may be personal for a moment, and to be delivered here in this country and as a guest of this section for some 40 years, during which every possible kindness, help, and adoption into families have been my many privileges. And I wish to begin by uttering very deeply from my heart my grateful thanks, my profound gratitude for all that has been received by my beloved wife Sandra herself and myself by the Theosophical Society here in New Zealand. And in addition, by the by, as if that were not enough, we have been provided, yes, we've been provided without payment with a lovely home of our own in which we lived in comfort for some time and from which we came here, brought here by one of our younger members of the society. So it is with loving gratitude and a sense of belonging to a family that I am privileged to be with you here again this evening and, yes, to think over, share some of the profound teachings of theosophy upon the great problems of the world and our subject this evening. The thought comes to me, and I'm allowed to respond. As we are sitting here together, the world, is it not, is in grave danger. And when we hope for a continuance of world peace, whilst it still seems to be safe, it is not wholly so because of what is going on over near the land and country of, with its capital, Buenos Aires. And the latest news is not good. And so, when I listened just now to our chairman's utterance of the first object of the Theosophical Society, I felt how tremendous is the need that the work of this society should grow stronger and stronger and more worldwide until that first object is fulfilled, to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, sex, or color. the first object of the Theosophical Society. The word, by the by, is a Greek word. It means divine wisdom. Very ancient word. And within it, we are this evening to think together of what perhaps might be called the Department of the Occult Sciences. And therefrom, we would hope to find an answer to some of the, yes, still perplexing problems of human life. For example, we might, any one of us, ask, and we'll see on the screen later, what and where is the propellant power which causes all cellular nature to participate in the procedure of reproduction? Why does the male or positive element ever feel drawn, and thereafter reproduction may occur? And this having been followed, an apparently infinite variety of results. And why do each of these proceed to grow? Yes, the embryos, for example, always are strictly according to nature's laws. I think I would like at that point to show you slides that I have collected on this particular subject. Now, after 3 weeks, the heart begins to beat, and it's not known how it is that long before that, a small group of cells has formed itself into that wonderful organ. And after 4 weeks, limb buds appear. After 5 weeks, the brain is divided into three parts and the limbs grow. After 6 weeks, the eyes begin to take shape. After 7 weeks, amazingly, teeth, muscles, and genitals begin to form. And after 8 weeks, yes, all the organs are in place, and the embryo has become a fetus. Natural questions arise. How are these changes brought about? Yes. What does theosophy say to us, the ageless wisdom, theosophia, divine wisdom, say to us in answer to our very natural question? Yes, perhaps I might use one sentence. By means of the cosmic creative power called Kundalini Shakti, Sanskrit, the invisible operative force, omnipresent in all cellular life on Earth, continually active throughout all nature. Our subject, Kundalini Shakti, the invisible generative force, omnipresent in all cellular life on Earth, continually active throughout nature. I don't need this now, do I? Now, when specialized and enclosed within the spinal cord of man, it is called Kundalini, which, by the by, Sanskrit word, it means coiled up. a coiled up force or power. Shakti means power. A coiled up power that moves in a serpentine path. Extremely powerful, hence one of its names, the serpent fire. In you, in us, in human beings, it is sheathed with care, but we have to learn to safely to set it free. It is Kundalini, yes, it is essentially creative, and though as yet but slightly aroused, with all other forces and powers of nature, it is present. Kundalini is present as a mighty power within the body of man. And there, at this period of human evolution, Kundalini manifests itself as the source of both the sex impulse and the nerve fluid. Kundalini, where is it then, we might ask, where is it in the body? I will show you in slides directly, and we will see that Kundalini resides coiled, as its name suggests, serpent-like, in the sacral wheel or center at the base of the spine, which in its turn is a relay station for the similarly coiled up energy, which is, by the by, at the very center of the earth, and there a kind of storehouse of the solar Kundalini. Now in man, in ourselves, when Kundalini is fully aroused, either by yoga or as a natural result of evolutionary progresses, it flows, as we will see later, it flows up an etheric canal in the spinal cord. This is called the Sushumna Nadi. Passing through it, which it centers itself in great important parts of the body. For example, as you'll see directly when the slides come, when Kundalini passes through the spinal centers, some of its force flows down the axis of the funnel by which each center is shaped, vivifying it occultly, and thereby awakening the individual to self-conscious awareness in the super-physical world. Important for our subject this evening. I repeat, may I? As I say it, I see it's the key. As Kundalini passes through the spinal centers, in which the wheels arise, as you will see, some of its force flows down the funnel, vivifying it occultly, and thereby awakening the individual to self-conscious awareness in the super-physical world. As it rises up the spinal cord, it is accompanied by two complementary forces, one of which is positive and the other negative. I brought slides of these, by the by. Each of these flows along its own canal within the spinal cord, and they are called Pingala, by the by, that's the positive one, and Ida, they're negative. And these two oppositely polarized forces meet and cross at each of the centers as they arise, and finally pass out through into, out through the very crown of the head, leaving the individual hypersensitive. Now, even as I'm saying that, which may sound rather technical and distant, I'm really revealing very dangerous truths. And I want, in consequence, to ask you here, please, to allow me to utter a very serious warning. To all of us, it's a warning against unwise attempts. Listen to those, and there are those who are in these moods, I know, if not here. I solemnly warn against unwise attempts to arouse into activity the creative power in universe and man known as Kundalini. Please remember, warning. What are the dangers? There are very many. May I mention a few? Abnormal sexual desire, pain in the brain, whirling sensations. By the by, that's one of the common ones, a whirling sensation in the brain. Misinterpreted clairvoyant visions, so that the people are misled themselves and they believe others, mislead others. Also, hearing voices. Queer, nobody's there, but voices are heard all the time. And oh, yes, the next one on my list, I see. Very important also. If Kundalini is brought up prematurely, in the wrong conditions and the wrong attitude, then there is another result, an increasing sense of self-importance. Oh, one of the greatest dangers of all, which can be followed by eccentricities of conduct. How may we guard ourselves? May I repeat four ways amongst a great number of others. Complete physical relaxation when meditating. Have personal disinterestedness containing success or failure in the spiritual life. Have the highest possible disease, namely, to be an increasingly effective servant of one's fellow human being. The only correct motive, the only safe motive, the slightest sense of wanting to be superior to others, and even to air oneself and carry oneself and talk and act as such, fatal. The Kundalini Shakti is already beginning to do its grave harm. Hence my warning, my friends, and I ask that, yes, they be remembered. Now, I think I would like you to see the slides illustrating what I have attempted to describe. Thank you. Lights out, and the first slide of Kundalini. There, I've just added the back of a human being. I wanted that to be the first one, to make it all really physical and real for us. Down at where the sternum is, where the base of the spinal column, which you see with the ribs on some sides, there is where Kundalini is stored. And then when it begins to be aroused, naturally or enforcedly, it ascends a triple current right up into the head. There it arrives, bringing with it its triple power, affecting very greatly very different aspects of thought and consciousness. There, perhaps, you see the cerebellum on the right. That's a cross-cut section, vertically right through the middle of the head. And you see the spinal cord arising, first of all on the right. There is the cerebellum, and then the brain itself, and the third ventricle, and the pineal, pituitary, and other glands. There is the picture of the three currents flowing up windingly, or coiled up, up through the spinal cord, up into the head. And there you see them together, and that rather symbolic picture on the right. One of the effects, the feeling of being free from the limitations of one's body and even of the world, Hermes-like. Another rather good drawing done by our members down in Christchurch with me many years ago. There you see Ida and Pingala and the central and encircling streams flowing up. The winged state is symbolical, again truly so, because when thus aroused, the individual becomes free of the limitations of the physical world. There in the correct colors, blue as you see them there, the same subject, and again the winged consciousness out through the top of the head. Now here you have the yogi, actually in the well-known yogic posture, very good one because it represents the upper and lower triangles, divine and bodily, within the body, and it shows you now the Kundalini is aroused in color and the severed centers are alight and alive. Base of the spine, two of them further up, the first one, by the by, is the spleen, the next one is the solar plexus, and the next one above higher, there between the shoulders, the heart, a center, which by the by might give you the name of. The Sanskrit name of these centers is chakram. C-H-A-K-R-A-M. It means wheel. And if you see them, they're spinning very, very rapidly. Then the blue chakram at the throat, another at the eye, and there is the seventh chakram at the crown of the head, fully aroused in a meditating yogi. Now just to show you those chakras, that's the one at the base of the spine, at the sternum, four petals. Then the spleen, six as you see, the colors being fairly accurate. Next the solar plexus, very dangerous one. When that becomes awakened, there can be a susceptibility to very unwelcome influences. Or never, if I may say so, never meditate at the solar plexus. Never below the heart. Remember, in fifth race man at the week, you and I, never meditate, never center the consciousness below the heart. Gravely dangerous, as sensitivities from previous periods can cause grave disorders. Now the throat chakra, blue. When that is fully aroused, one of the results is clairaudience, under control. There is the brow chakra, and that is the center between the eyes, on the forehead, and is the center for many people who are aroused for clairvoyant research. And where minute objects, subatomic and atomic, are to be studied, a magnifying tube can be projected from the center, as I'll show you later on. There is the wonderful so-called thousand-petaled lotus at the crown of the head. And when this is fully awakened, then the individual is free of the body and can leave it at will and return thereto, with all the resultant added powers of effectiveness in the service of fellow men, fully under control, the one ideal, under selfless, fully control. Then the mighty power, which we've studied together this evening, very much in outline, remember, can successfully be aroused. And the teaching tells us this. Allow me to repeat to you some age-old teaching. When arousing the kundalini and consequent development of the occult powers would be deemed helpful to any person, listen, friends, a spiritual teacher will always present him or herself and will guide the neophyte safely through the dangers and difficulties likely to arise. Or as an ancient saying has it, when the pupil is ready, the master will appear. The ideal of discipleship to a master can be fulfilled in these days. No one, says the ageless teachings, so I understand, no one is ever overlooked. And the qualifications to become completely selfless, self-disciplined service of humanity, the one permitted objective. When the student is ready, it is taught, the knowledge arrives. And one function of the great brotherhood of the perfected human beings, male and female, on our planet, one of the great functions of certain of them is to recruit and train, illumine servants of the human race. Yes, and I remember saying, the Theosophical Society is regarded by some, all being free, the Theosophical Society is regarded by some as a gateway. And on this, I feel I am coming to believe. And this, dear friends, this closes my remarks on the subject of Kundalini Shakti. And now I hand the meeting back to our president.
Now, two doctors have given their ideas or on the authenticity of Mr. Hudson's clairvoyance. The first, I'm only just giving you a very brief outline. The first is fortunate enough to work with Mr. Hudson. and there is no doubt whatever in my mind that Geoffrey possesses quite remarkable powers of extraordinary sensitive perception, and invariably uses these faculties with meticulous regard for accuracy in both observation and description. And then Dr. Robinson, who we'll see on a slide later, says, I was able to work very closely with Mr. Hodgson for some months during the late 50s, testing his clairvoyant powers on pieces of fossil of early man about 2 million years ago. Each says, I was impressed by the extreme care he took over being accurate and as clear as he could be in the observations he made, as well as his description of them in such a way that his words were as precise as possible in offering the least possible misinterpretation. As far as I could determine, his information was always accurate, and he gave me a strong impression of complete reliability. Just a small explanation saying that these slides and tapes were recorded in 1960 during Mr. Hodgson's researches into the origin of fossils discovered beneath the veldt in South Africa. During his fully conscious clairvoyant investigation of fossils, under the close observation of Professor John Robinson, Doctor of Paleontology in South Africa. The coldness of the air in the cave below the veldt made it necessary for Mr. Hodgson to be covered by a warm rug during these sessions. The reclining position is most comfortable and relaxing during the long period of successive, fully conscious, intensive, clairvoyant research. These slides and his vocal commentaries are quite contrary to Mr. Hodgson's custom as a teacher of theosophy, which by all students, and therefore himself, is regarded as a totally impersonal wisdom. These illustrations, I might add, had never been made publicly available before. I will now ask Mr. Hodgson to now explain these other slides.
I expect you are all aware that the science of paleontology deals with the finding, cataloging, and interpretation of the diverse and abundant evidences of earlier life on our planet. The term fossil also, Latin fossilium, that means, by the by, something dug up. Fossil refers not only to the bones, shells, teeth, and other hard parts of a plant or animal body which have been preserved, but to any impression or trace left by some previous organism. And as a student of this subject from the theosophical point of view, I of course became fully concerned with another of the teachings of theosophy, age old. It has a rather strange name. It refers to the existence of a substance in nature that normally mankind does not consciously contact. Apparently, impressions, or if you like, yes, memories of nature, are referred to in occult science as occult records, or in the Sanskrit words, akashic records. Funny word, A-K-A-S-H-I-C, the adjective, the akashic records, contact attained by those who are able to associate themselves with this memory of nature. Apparently, according to the teachings and experiences, the akashic records are not asleep. Akasha itself is a kind of element like the air, omnipresent, all accommodating, all pervading, and limitless as a recorder of all events, and yes, I should say, all events and sounds. Extraordinary, isn't it? There is such an element. Everything that happens, apparently, is restored and available in and by the Akasha. It's possible to go back into the old civilizations, to see them as they were, even to find oneself there, I would suppose, far in ancient Greece and Egypt and elsewhere, perhaps, in the Far East or the Americas, because by virtue of the Akasha, every event is stored, preserved, and every sound also, so that the occult observer can discover all of these events. Now, which really means all accommodating, all permeating, all pervading, and again I repeat, a limitless recorder of events and sounds. Now, contrary to my wishes, I'm going to show you some of the slides illustrating myself attempting, and I must say to you, attempting to make these theosophical teachings as real as I can and find out the knowledge which becomes available. Now I think we have the lights out. And I have the first slide. Oh yes. Now this research into fossils was carried out in South Africa in a deep down in a cave or, yes, hole right down below the veld at a place called Sterkfontein, not too far away from Pretoria in the museum, and a study of which Dr. John Robinson is or was engaged. Now, there I am, and I go down, and you see him waiting for me to come and begin with fossils. I just want to read to you, as you will hear my voice trying to say this, what I found. He handed me, as you'll see directly, one of those pieces of bone. And so I tried, with my very great limitations, my friends, and I let myself go, and I said, flesh eater, definitely shaped forehead, upper and lower jaws protuberant, noticeable teeth, underslung lower jaw, prominent bridge above the eyes, nose raised but not high, teeth without gaps, and primitively only the figure looks man-like. So I ventured, slowly as you'll hear, to share what I thought I was seeing. And he, the doctor, when he printed it all, wrote, identification very accurate, though I know one can make, and I must surely make, many mistakes. Now, there we are down there, and you can hardly see me. I'm lying down because the body must be fully relaxed if one is going to use occult powers. Very cold down there, so they were kind to provide me with a rug. And there, you can't see him, was the doctor and the electric tape recorder of everything. from which the results were drawn. Now there you see him looking at me, and there I am with just having been handed a bone or two, which I have as yet only in my hand. And there he is, utterly detached like a scientist. There's the recorder, and I begin. But before I do so, I must... Pardon? I must now use that special tube that I have spoken about recently, protuberant from the chakra between the eyes. And with that, it is possible, yes, to make enlargements and also to tune in to the akasha of the subject which is placed in your charge. There I had a fossil, and I put it between my eyes and said those words which I have just repeated to you. Now we'll see me with others. Now there, I don't know whether you can see that, it's not dark enough, friends, but I put it because you see the brow chakra, and if you could see, try again. Ah, that's better. There's the brow chakra, and you see protruding in front of it the special tube which enables you to make your contact with the Akashic records and to magnify the very minutest objects. There I am lying, as you see, talking away as best I can and being recorded. So now we have the tape recording of my voice whilst I was doing that. What on earth did I say? Please.
This is Peggy Donnelly, Geoffrey Hudson and John Robinson in the Broome Memorial Chamber at Stadfontein. We are about to start an investigation into supposed artifacts from Stadfontein. The first one is a piece of bone. The others are chipped stone.
The date is March 14th,
1960.
This is a young male, member of a family that lived together and is very early removed from ape to man. And I see now an elder. Yes, surely that's ape man. Yes, ape man. And this is a little boy. This is what we would call a boy. I don't know whether I can get how much ground. It's awkward. It's lying down. Oh, yes, there are those beetling brows, deep-set eyes. Yes. The father, the male, oh, yes, that male there is distinctly Australopithecus. Oh, yes, it is. Yes, I must adhere to that. I was a little led away by the body, but now the family is... Now, I've got to stand by that.
This is the 16th of March, 1960. Geoffrey Hodson, John Robinson, and Peggy Donnelly, investigating specimen SEA-157.
And try to describe it. It has risen. It walks erect. It has a club in its right hand. It is capable of standing erect like a man and walks off to its half left, slightly downhill, swinging its club, which I'll try and describe. Now I see its hands dark palm, dark skin on the palms, thumb gripping the right, and the gripping in its right hand a club. It's wood. Wood handle, getting thicker, weighted at the end artificially. This being is capable of constructing some very simple, elementary kind of weapon. Doesn't seem to be warlike, ferocious, rather docile. At any rate, the mood it's in now, it's looking around, side to side. It's got hair on its face, but it's much more man-shaped face than baboon or ape. In fact, it's peculiar. Its back is covered with hair. It's a very crude, rough kind of a creature. It's peering into the undergrowth, into the trees and bush. It's looking here and looking there as if searching for something or expecting something. As I watch it, it doesn't seem to see anything special. Keeps its club. It definitely is able to stand upright. It's nearly a man, this. Very much more nearly a man than an ape. And I'm now talking less anatomically than I'm sensing a little the state of its consciousness, which is ruminative and even capable of some kind of instinctual deduction from what it sees.
This is John Robinson at Stokefontaine in the Broome Memorial Chamber. With me is Peggy Donnelly and Mr. Hodson. We are going to attempt on this occasion to make a comparison, a comparative study between two specimens, specimen E and specimen F, the object being to try to determine whether these specimens come from the same type of creature or whether they represent two different creatures.
The date is 10th of March, 1960.
Mr. Hodson was here handed specimen E.
First impressions of the psychology of the apparent owner of this tooth. It is crude, capable of a snarling ferocity and excited anger. It is not eating this time. I'm looking at it in profile. It's definitely man-like. However, primitively so, it's got a profile which shows a raised nose. It's got a skull which is manlike, rounded, very low above the forehead. It's not far from the ape. There are some very ape-like attributes, I think, but it's got a man's, in quotation mark, soul. Or psychology, preponderant over pure subhuman animality. Its nose isn't very much raised, but it is raised, not flat. Its eyes are brown. I see them rather well. Small, but good eyes, good-looking eyes. They're deep-set, as I said. It's the same thing, I think. Same creature. Hairy, lot of hair, forehead. Very big eyebrows. That ridge that I've spoken about before, the eyebrow hair is rough and long. It's not very far away from ape, but it is distinctly superior to it. Now, it's there we are. It's also very dim. It's like looking through a mist to see it. This morning, just exactly. The Akasha itself, you see, is a kind of whitish grey mist and all pervading. And through the specimen, in this, as if looking through a transparent muslin curtain, is this face. It's not quite as easy for me this morning as the other day. I see it, though. Yes, it's got ferocity. Now, is there any one single characteristic you could ask me, John, to focus on for a bit, which might help you? Ready? I am asked whether the canine teeth are, as in the ape, longer and prominent, or as in man, hardly noticeable. I'm now going to try and find that out. I think the answer is yes, that the canine teeth are longer than in man, that modern man. Is there anything else, John? All right. Diet.
Yes, I think I'm right.
But it's ugly. Not? Pardon? Whatever else it eats, I have it better now. Whatever else it eats, it does include some flesh in its diet, and I see some bones. I see some bones about at the side of it. Yes, tibia and fibula, like bones. There's an upper arm bone, I think. Yes. It's a very unpleasant customer indeed. I dislike it. It's brutal and cruel and animalistic, naturally, for its stage of evolution. Yes, it stands upright. It's got certain man characteristics. Yes, the face is not ape, but not an ape face in the senses that you showed me the pictures. No, it's more vertical. Features are more vertical. Low forehead. Big ridge over the eyes. Yes, goes back. Yes, in the dome, very low, very much lower than man's. Right, back. Yes. Oh, there it is. That's better. I'm afraid to mislead you. It's got a lot of very ape-like characteristics. It must be just on the verge. And I should say almost, if you saw it yourself, you'd say it's got more ape than man about it. But it's not. It is, I think, definitely a man. Yes. Just. It's interesting. Just emerging.
And there you see me, friends, together with Dr. Robinson, outside the deep cave, after we have been working together in the study of fossils, and in my, as you heard, clumsy, very slow attempts to gain some kind of reading of the Akasha. And may I, as I close, please repeat the warning. Never attempt to arouse into activity this creative power in universe and man, unless the ideal is absolutely impersonal and selfless, the mind is clear, and there's a certain emptiness when you go into the research. What I often call with Sandra, who works with me sometimes, I call the great essential. And I'm using my own language now. The great essential I've found within these limitations to success is, ready, the white sheet. The mind must be like a white sheet, so that nothing in your own concept at all affects the effect of attempted research into any field of nature, even into the wisdom itself, the white sheet, and of course, utter selflessness of motive. Then, with care, and when knowledge has arrived, and perhaps so it is told, a teacher could not be too far away, then this great aspect, the occult sciences, in theosophy, may be studied at least. And again I warn, as I close, never without strict guidance of an advanced teacher. And now again, as we do close, my, with Sandra, loving thanks to the members of the Theosophical Society of New Zealand, from which so much of loving kindness, practical helpfulness has been received. Indeed, yes, Sandra, I think I may say we've really been adopted into the family. And so to you all, I would say, you are part of our family. Thank you.